Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The Republican Party, as expressed through its primary voters, is going to try to adjust to the changed circumstances of the 2006 elections. In Rhode Island, you've got a moderate incumbent, Lincoln Chafee, who most conservatives in the party don't like very much, and they think he's somebody who defies the president. They have a conservative alternative in the primary, Steve Laffey, but that's somebody who, in the judgment of senior strategists in the party, can't win the general election.
Who's the party backing?
Well, the party is backing Chafee, and the question is whether the voters go along with that. Are they recognizing that the pragmatic judgment that the party establishment has made and said, we've got to stick with Chafee even though we don't like him, because that's our best chance of winning and keeping a majority in the Senate? It's a fascinating test of how voters actually execute in a political stressful situation.
Right. Steve Laffey, he's a former investment banker and mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island, who's been out campaigning hard. What else are you keeping your eye on, again, to see how much the party faithful stick with the party line?
Very similar test in Arizona, in the 8th District, which is on the border with Mexico, a place where immigration is an extremely hot issue. You had a moderate Republican member of Congress, Jim Colby, who is leaving the Congress, and Jim Colby has endorsed a moderate successor to him, Steve Huffman. But Huffman, again, is one who does not have a lot of popularity with the strong conservatives in the party. They have an alternative, Randy Graff. Republican leaders are making the argument that Graff can't win the election. Again, same test as in Rhode Island. Are they going to look to the center of the electorate in order to hold on for the party, or are they going to stick with their ideology?
Well, and let's turn to the speech last night, because some say there was ideology in that, even though aides in the run-up to the speech said the president would concentrate on honoring the victims of 9/11. Voters going to the polls today have to be thinking about the wars in Iraq and on terrorism, President Bush using the 9/11 speech last night to link those two again. Let's listen.
The safety of America depends on the outcome of the battle in the streets of Baghdad. Osama bin Laden calls this fight the Third World War, and he says that victory for the terrorists in Iraq will mean America's defeat and disgrace forever. If we yield Iraq to men like bin Laden, our enemies will be emboldened. They will gain a new safe haven. They will use Iraq's resources to fuel their extremist movement. We will not allow this to happen.
John Harwood, there's already been some backlash today from Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, but some would say that that doesn't really count because it's predictable. Does it count? I mean, do you think there will be backlash to that, or is that working on stump?
Well, I don't know if there's going to be backlash to it, but the president's speech was obviously political, and of course, sometimes the best politics is what is not obviously cast as politics. He was making the same arguments in that speech last night that he makes in the speeches that he's been giving around the country, in which he's cautioning against people who want to pull out prematurely as potentially appeasing the terrorists. So there's really no different. He was using a solemn occasion and trying to deliver his message. And his message is, I've got the right policy, and we need to stick with it. His problem is that this president has less persuasive power than he used to be. His credibility has been damaged by various things, everything from not finding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq to other subjects. He simply, after 3 years of warfare that haven't gone the way the administration expected, he's got a challenge in trying to keep the American people with him.
Again, Senator Kennedy saying that the president should be ashamed of himself for using 9/11 to seek support for the war in Iraq, even though the president admitted in the speech last night the war in Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 in a way. But do you think we'll be hearing more of that message? Others are saying it is working out on the campaign trail.
We're going to be hearing that message, Robin, all the way through until Election Day in November. Republicans, by and large, are standing with the president and saying, yes, there may have been problems in the execution of this war, and some of us may have problems like Democrats do with Don Rumsfeld, but it was the right thing to do. A lot of Democrats don't feel that it was the right thing to do, and they're calling for the American voters to express a change of course.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. He also writes the Washington Wire column for The Wall Street Journal. John, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, today we want to spend some time looking at some quickly evolving developments in the president's war on terrorism. His decision to transfer 14 high-value terror suspects to Guantanamo Bay and try them in a type of military court with special rules, including one that might prohibit the detainees from seeing the evidence against them. The Washington Post reports today that Republican senators who criticized that idea have made some key concessions to the White House. We'll have more on that in a moment from a lawyer's point of view. But first, we're learning more about the 14 most dangerous of the dangerous detainees who will be tried in these courts. They run from 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to a former Baltimore High School student said to be planning poison attacks on U.S. reservoirs. Well, joining us on the line first is Washington Post reporter Daphna Linzer. Welcome, Daphna.
Thanks, Robin.
And let's take a look at just one set of links that connects just some of these detainees. We mentioned 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He had a relative named Ammar al-Baluchi, one of the other 14 detainees. Baluchi is accused of delivering funds to the 9/11 hijackers, correct?
That's right. And he went as far as to marry a woman named Aifa Siddiqui, sent her into the United States, and she's alleged to have helped bring in other people, including Majid Khan.
Well, let's stop you right there. Aifa Siddiqui is a well-known name here in the Boston area. She was a former MIT student, became a Boston neuroscientist, respected by her colleagues. They were stunned when this accusation was made.
That's right. It was stunning and remains so. And she, her whereabouts is also unknown to this day. She also helped bring in a gentleman, as you described earlier, Majid Khan, who is accused of conducting research on poisoning U.S. water reserves.
And this is a young man she's alleged to have brought in 96 with his family, and they ran a gas station. He worked at the gas station in Maryland. He went to high school in Baltimore.
That's right. And a lot of that information apparently stems from the interrogations of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some of the other 14 suspects. We had senior administration officials in the White House tell reporters last week that 50% of their leads on al-Qaeda were generated from the interrogations of these 14 suspects whose identities they made public and who they transferred to Guantanamo Bay last week.
Well, I just want to stop and ask you about just that one, you know, linkage that we were talking about. Mohammed gives money to his relative who marries an al-Qaeda operative, bringing her to go to MIT to become a neuroscientist, to then bring in another fellow who works at a gas station who's allegedly going to, you know, poison reservoirs and maybe blow up gas stations. That allegation seems like a lot of efforting to get to the one last jihadist, this alleged jihadist, this high schooler in Baltimore.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the links and connections that you described are key here for the administration and things that they are working hard to highlight in trying to explain why these 14 people are so important and that they do lead from one to the other in kind of a domino effect. And in fact, they claim that the first person they caught, Abu Zubaydah, in fact, led them to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and so the investigation goes.
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, by the way, the fellow who was arrested in his pajamas in Pakistan 3 years ago, some people might remember that image, again, said to be the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. But you claim in your reporting to have exposed a flaw in the Bush administration claim that it was this interrogation, this tough interrogation that the president spoke of, that led them to this information because apparently, as you report, the CIA knew Sheikh Mohammed's nickname before 9/11. It wasn't received for the first time through detainee Abu Zubaydah.
That's right. I think it's important to remember that the information that the president detailed in his speech last week and that the White House revealed in other supporting documents are very selected pieces of information that they say bolsters the case for having held these people in secret facilities. As we reported, the president said that they got key information from Abu Zubaydah that led them to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. In fact, one of those key pieces was known beforehand. There were others that were known beforehand as well, and other information information that we have not received from the White House. It's always important to remember what they don't say rather than what they do, and that is how that information was extracted. We don't know under what conditions. We don't know how much information Abu Zubaydah gave them that, in fact, turned out to be wrong.
Let's tick through the other detainees. Abu Zubaydah, the Palestinian raised in Saudi Arabia, thought to be planning attacks in Israel, and again, thought to be one of the first to start giving information that had this sort of domino effect. Suspected coal bombing mastermind Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, thought to be planning attacks in the United Arab Emirates, as well as on U.S. military sites in Saudi Arabia. And you note that all 14 detainees fall into two basic categories. What are those?
Well, there's those who were involved with al-Qaeda and those who were involved with groups connected to it, like groups in Malaysia, which is the Jamaah Islamiyah group.
What's next for these detainees?
That's a good question. The Bush administration says it plans to put them on trial through military tribunals. It's trying to push through legislation to make that possible in Congress. What's next for the detainees is that they will be meeting with lawyers. They will be meeting with representatives from the International Red Cross. For some of them who have been held since 2002 and 2003, this will be the first time that they will be seeing people other than interrogators. And I think that means that the public will probably begin to learn much more about the conditions that they were in.
Daphna Linzer, staff writer for The Washington Post. Daphna, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we turn now to George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. And Professor Turley, we want to note you're involved in a completely separate case that's defending a Muslim cleric in Virginia who says he may have been wiretapped without a warrant. But we want your thoughts on these detainees and the alleged links between some of them. I mean, some say that's how al-Qaeda works very patiently, but it seems like a lot of work to get just one jihadist into the country.
Well, many of us are very skeptical, and the reason is that linkages made by the administration since weapons of mass destruction have become increasingly questionable from this administration. You know, the administration is looking at what it realizes is going to be a very embarrassing period as these detainees, for the first time, speak to the Red Cross and outside parties. I expect we're going to find out that they were tortured, at least some of them. With things like waterboarding, which is viewed as torture under international law. And so the administration is trying to anticipate that by saying, whatever these guys say, whatever may be true, look at all the great stuff we got, that even if you think this is torture, it really did serve a purpose. Well, you know, it's very, very questionable from the outset. They simply say that these interrogations contributed to, for example, foiling the attacks in England. And it's very, very ambiguous.
Law Professor Jonathan Turley, tell you what, we're going to take a quick break, and then Jonathan will be back to look at the questions of evidence. What access to evidence, if any, should these detainees have in these possible military tribunals? Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Compromise requires that any evidence used at a trial be declassified or summarized. But that's something the president doesn't want to do. So, Jonathan Turley, is that a middle ground of sorts?
What is a middle ground? Usually in these cases, the administration, through the Classified Information Procedures Act, can ask the court to use redacted or summarized versions of evidence. And the court then makes a decision whether those would be adequate. And so that is certainly a compromise from where the administration was going. The administration had rules that, frankly, did shock the conscience for most people. It would allow for the use of hearsay evidence. It didn't have the type of authentication of evidence to guarantee it's real instead of manufactured that we see in real courts. It allowed evidence to be used without showing the evidence to the defendant. All these things resulted in an outcry internationally that this is only a trial with the most tortured definition, that it doesn't have any of the basic elements that you need.
We'll use that phrase, shock the conscience, and it comes up in another aspect. The Washington Post also reports that his Senate critics have made concessions in other ways, that detainees can still sue U.S. personnel for abuse during these interrogations, but only if that abuse shocks the conscience, and a military judge would be the arbiter, and detainees would not be allowed to collect damages. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I must say I find this compromise to be incredibly depressing, that they're trying to rush through this legislation before the full account of what happened to these people is made public. That's the reason this is all on a fast track, because the White House wants, as they did with 9/11, to quickly get the legislation in before the public finds out what it's been doing. I find it, frankly, outrageous that the administration is saying, we don't want anyone to be able to sue for just torture. It's got to be torture that shocks the conscience of a military judge. The question is, why? Torture has been illegal in this country for decades.
And of course, the other question we had is, it depend, you know, whose conscience?
Right. But the thing is, the obligation not to use torture is one of the defining aspects of a civilized nation. For the administration to push this through is to say, we don't want our people to have any ramifications for the use of torture unless it shocks the conscience of this judge. In my view, that is going to reinforce the view that we are a hypocritical and rogue nation. The other reason they want to do this, by the way, is because they know that if these people can be sued, then these cases are going to bring out to the public what has been done.
Well,
and
Jonathan,
they know what happened with Abu Ghraib.
Jonathan Turley, I'm going to ask you to do something that you might be loath to do, and that is to take a completely different point of view on this, to sit on a bench on the other side of the aisle in a courtroom, and argue the case of someone who might say, what happens if a detainee is acquitted and can hear the evidence against him, and in so doing hears classified material about, say, an agent or another Al-Qaeda representative who's giving up information, and takes that information once he's free to the wrong people?
Well, I think that there is obviously a well-founded concern that these are people that have connections to Al-Qaeda or terrorist groups, and that if they learn information in the course of their trial that could compromise U.S. interests, then you could have more people die. You could compromise intelligence programs. And so the process of trying to convict these people could result, if they're acquitted, in a significant blow to U.S. security and possibly loss of lives. Now, the counter side to that is that we deal with that all the time in federal court, that the federal law already has in it an act that protects against disclosure of classified information. It's a whole process that you can use for precisely that problem. One of the concerns that many of us who try these cases have with what's happening on Capitol Hill is that the presumption behind all these compromises is totally false. We've tried terrorism cases for decades involving the same type of intelligence. We've never had a compromise. But these senators want to compromise for political reasons. They want to be able to go back to their states and say, well, we gave the president something. But we have an entire apparatus that we have used for decades for these cases.
Well, but Jonathan, Jerry, yeah. Let me just jump in there and say we've never had a war that didn't end, which others have said. You know, that previous to this, wars have ended and war criminals have been tried and evidence presented because the war is over.
You know, that's a lot like saying, you know, we need to change the rules for dealing with burglary because we still have burglaries occurring. I mean, terrorism is a crime that has preexisted this declaration of war. It is going to exist for the rest of our lives. Does that mean that we're going to turn our backs on international principles for the rest of the duration of this republic? I mean, the fact is that we existed until this president within the confines of international law on fighting terrorism, and we foiled plots, and we convicted al-Qaeda terrorists, and we did not have the leak of information. And much of what is being put forward by the White House is completely fallacious. You know, the argument that we need these because evidence will be compromised. They pretend that we've never tried al-Qaeda people with secret evidence before, which is totally untrue.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, remind us, are you referring to the one-eyed sheikh, as he's called?
Yes, we've done other terror. We've tried other terrorist groups with classified information, with the use of summaries. There's an entire federal law designed to do this.
You're referring to Ramzi Youssef, who was accused of plotting the first bombing of the World Trade Center.
That's correct.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, from Arizona to Florida, we'll look at some new voter ID laws that could change the political landscape. Stay with us. Much more ahead today, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And Pegasystems, offering smart business process management software, driving business agility for growth, productivity, and compliance, online at pega.com.
Rescue kids from inner-city gangs and drugs and help them prepare to enter top magnet high schools in Baltimore. Filmmakers Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady documented this school experiment in their film The Boys of Baraka, which airs tonight on the PBS series POV. It's a film of hope with a devastating twist at the end. But to the hope first. We first spoke to Heidi Ewing last year when the film was released in theaters, and we started off by listening to a film clip of one of the boys. He's Richard, and in the film he was 12 years old and looking for a way out of Baltimore for himself and his younger brother, Romesh.
My neighborhood is mostly about drugs. For real. People that's out here doing drugs, sticking needle, and they all messing up their blood. I know I'm smart. If I'm not around stupid and dumb people. And I don't want my brother, my baby brother anyway, to grow up in no project.
I fell in love with Richard when watching this film.
You and everyone else.
Yeah. Can you tell us, you spent so much time filming this. It's over the course of several years of their lives. Can you just describe some of the challenges that Richard and the other boys were facing in Baltimore?
These kids come from impoverished neighborhoods, many boarded up homes. On your way to school, you know, you're offered many different types of drugs or asked to come work for the drug dealers. They're living with many siblings and uncles and aunts, and the mother, mom's got two jobs and dad's in jail or not there. And so I would say that it's a very stressful environment for a child to grow up in.
Well, in the scenes that you show us early on in the Baltimore schools, Baltimore can't be happy about. I mean, they just are mayhem. Chairs flying, food flying, nobody listening. And so this is why this group is attempting to get them out of the schools. And how does this work? What's the group behind the Baraka School?
Well, the Baraka School was originally founded by the Able Foundation, which is a wonderful educational foundation in Baltimore. The concept was if you take the most disruptive few kids that are disrupting the rest of the class but have a lot of potential, if you take those kids and you remove them from the classroom and give them a chance to start over somewhere else, that everybody benefits.
Well, Richard is one of the candidates for the 2002 school year. There's a poignant moment in the beginning of the film where he goes to prison to visit his father, who spent 13 years in jail for shooting Richard's mother in the leg. She's still living. Let's listen to that scene.
We're going to Kenya. The name of the school is Baraka School. It's in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going there, so when I grow up, I'll be somebody. Mm-hmm. Don't gotta worry about coming to a place like this. Can't see my children, because I'm in here.
Yeah. You know what you're doing. You're smart enough to know.
Yep.
Heidi Ewing, as we listen to that scene, again, as I got to know Richard through your film, they are smart. He is smart.
Oh, he's so smart. He's got so much going for him. I mean, just listening to that scene, it's funny. I've seen it 100 times, and it gets me emotional. There is no reason that that child shouldn't graduate from Princeton or become a social worker or an attorney or a business. There is nothing should stop that kid. They've got everything it takes to be successful except the guidance and the education that they need.
Well, you focus on 3 boys during the course of your film, Richard, and then another student is Devon, who lives with his grandmother because his mother has been struggling with drug issues. Devon wants to be a preacher. We're going to actually speak to Devon in just a few minutes, but first, here's a clip from the beginning of the film where he's showing off his skills as an aspiring preacher.
When your daughter out there nip-napping, you just got to pray. Sometimes we just all should get together and bow down on our knees and confess with our tongue that he is Lord. Because when we praise his name and give him some glory, God will come and destroy us and he will take us back up to his kingdom. Somebody say yeah.
Yeah.
A scene from the film Boys of Baraka. That's Devon. We're going to speak to him in a bit. But filmmaker Heidi Ewing, the Baraka School targeted kids in Baltimore who were most at risk. He didn't seem at risk, you know, working on being a preacher.
Well, actually, Devon is considered at risk and was considered at risk because he was always mouthing off, getting in trouble with teachers, getting thrown out of class. He had a lot of anger. I think a lot of it does have to do with issues he was dealing with at home. And so while he didn't appear to have those kind of problems, he really did need some guidance and was definitely acting out a lot in school.
So these kids go to Kenya. Quite a culture shock. No junk food, no television, no fighting allowed. And when they first get there, they don't seem to like it very much. Here's another clip.
I miss everybody. I miss girls.
I would like you to send me some gum, some soda, some chips, and some candy.
Tell everybody I say hi. Tell the church I love them.
Some kids want to go home already. I'm one of them. You're not going to cry about it, Ma, because I am brave to do this.
It's just heartbreaking. They make tapes to send back home to their mothers. But eventually, and probably predictably, the special attention they get at this school, there's only 20 of them and they're out in the middle of nowhere, it starts to work.
It does start to work. It actually did work. I mean, we would go to Kenya every few months, and every few months when we arrived, we encountered new children. We were shocked. I mean, they really snapped into line there and got very excited, and they put all their competition that used to go into fighting into grades, and it became cool to be smart because along with good behavior and good grades came special privileges like movie night and a trip to the local village or a trip to Nairobi. And, you know, these kids are smart. They're like, all right, this is what I got to do to receive these rewards. And also they got some personal satisfaction with the accolades that they were being given at the school.
They connect with home. They have phone calls with home. But and there's such a contrast between the life in Africa and the reminder of what's going on at home. Here's a phone call between Devon and his family. And his mom has been in and out of jail. And, well, you'll hear they hold back some bad news that she's back in jail from him. Let's listen.
Hey, Grandma.
Yes?
Where Mommy at?
She hasn't come home yet.
Huh?
She spent the night with a friend of hers.
Oh.
Devon?
The other person has cleared.
Mwenzio amemaliza.
Go cut off.
The other person has cleared.
You know, in watching that scene, you have one camera in Baltimore, one in Kenya. When Devon asks where his mom is, everyone in the room in Baltimore just freezes because they don't want to tell him she's back in jail. And then when the line gets cut off, the look on his face, you know, where is everyone? It's a reminder that these kids are just escaping their real lives for a brief time.
Well, there is that sense of that contrast, the gap between their former lives in Baltimore and the new selves that they're encountering becomes wider and wider each day. And when the kids come home for summer break, I think they're shocked to find that while they might have moved leaps and bounds forward, at least internally, everything around them is the same and nothing has changed.
That's Heidi Ewing. She co-directed the award-winning documentary The Boys of Baraka. It airs on the PBS series POV tonight. The school takes its name from the Kiswahili word Baraka, meaning blessing, and it was founded by the Abel Foundation in 1996. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, one of the Baraka boys was Devin Brown. He's now at the Ace Academy High School in Baltimore. When we first aired this story, we called him at school, and he joined in on the conversation with filmmaker Heidi Ewing. While in Kenya, Devin got in trouble a few times once the counselors let him cool off by making him walk back to the dorms at night by himself. And I asked Devin what he thought about on that walk.
I was thinking, Lord, get me home. That's what I was thinking about. I was running, trying to find my way, you know, through the dark and everything. And, you know, I was tears was coming out of my eyes because I was scared. The only thing I could think about was I'm not coming back out here no more. I'm through with this. You know, get me back home. Lord, if you get me home, I swear I will be good.
Can I just say one thing? I just wanted to just to follow up on the night walk. The counselors always were there for those walks. They might have been sort of hanging behind, but just for clarity, the counselors didn't leave the kids out in the dark to walk home with animals and stuff.
Well, the Baraka School was a 2-year middle school program, again, to help prepare the boys to get into a top magnet high school in Baltimore. And the film follows the kids as they come home to Baltimore for their summer vacation after their first year in Kenya. And you can already see the changes taking place. Here's a clip of Richard. He's the young man whose father is in jail. He's realizing how much the Baraka School has changed him.
I stay in the house most of the time.
Not in front of none of these boys.
Let's look at them. Coke, dope, weed. They troublemakers, tell you that much.
Again, another scene from the Boys of Baraka. That's Richard. He's looking out his window, Devon, at that point, and he's looking at the kids, the drug dealers on the street. You came back and had concerns over your own. What was it like for you to come back?
I had to take what I have learned from over there, which is one thing is respect, responsibilities, and being a man and trying to get your education, bring it over here so now that I can come home, I am adapted.
But Devon, after you come back, there's another shock to the system. You guys find out that the Baraka School was closed because of security concerns. We remember there were the bombings in Mombasa, the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi closed. Parents were devastated when it was announced that the school was closed.
They might get killed here in Baltimore.
Right on the corner.
On the corner. Then they went over there.
My son is not going to be the next statistic that's going to be out here.
Heidi, this was devastating.
It seemed so unfair and so wrong to shut the school down, and it was more than just concerns over terrorism. I mean, the reality is that the embassy in Nairobi was only closed for 1 week, and that there, you know, the school, there were some financial concerns. There was definitely some controversy at the Able Foundation whether or not to keep the program alive. And I really have to say that I think it was kind of a good excuse to shut the program down.
Can you describe what you saw through the lens of Richard when the Baraka School closes? To me, it looked as if you could just see abandonment on his face.
It was extraordinarily painful to watch the light sort of drain out of Richard's eyes, because that was almost like, in his mind, the last straw. I mean, this is a kid who has had a lifetime full of disappointment. He's had promises made and broken over and over and over again, and he trusted the Baraka School and this program to deliver him 2 years of, escape, really, and that didn't happen.
Well, Devon, even though you didn't return to the Baraka School, you seem to be doing well. You were president of your class last year. Do you think that's all because of the Baraka School?
Pretty much, yes. I think if I haven't went to the Baraka School, I don't know how my life would have ended up. You know, I think I would probably been still doing, you know, acting out and getting suspended every day. So, you know, I would say, you know, it's all because of Baraka and first of all, because of Jesus Christ.
That was Devin Brown. He's still in high school and hosts a public access TV show. We also spoke with Heidi Ewing, who directed the film Boys of Baraka, airing on the PBS series POV Tonight. As for the other boys in the film, Richard dropped out of high school but is training to be a correctional officer through a Job Corps program. His younger brother, Romesh, is not faring as well. He dropped out of school and moves from one friend's house to the next. And despite what filmmaker Heidi Ewing suspected, we want to note that the Able Foundation has told us that the Baraka School was closed because of State Department warnings in Kenya, not because of financial considerations. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. classical music. He's just received an honorary doctorate from Berklee College of Music here in Boston, which he attended in 1979, and he joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What a pleasure to meet you. And should I say welcome, Dr. Marsalis?
No, honorary is not the real deal, so I appreciate the honor. But I will certainly refrain from calling myself doctor.
Well, you know, it's funny because we were just shooting the breeze. You made a comment about, you know, back in the day when I didn't practice as much as I should have. What's your assessment of yourself as an artist? You just had an interesting one.
I've always felt there's a difference between playing an instrument and playing music. So I did not physically practice the saxophone, but I was constantly listening to music and absorbing music, which is why I was able to work so much. And there were a lot of, you know, some you actually know, unbelievable technicians on all instruments. Mm. And my response to that when it would be brought up to me was that if technique were really that important, I wouldn't be working at all because I don't have any. But after I left Jay's show, I turned 36 and said my life, it is entirely conceivable at this point that my life could be half over. And I really haven't found out what my potential is and I need to just go ahead and do it. And that's when I really started to practice.
Were you the kid? Were you the sibling? And in large families, there's usually one. It just comes so darn easy to you. You know, things came a little easy to you. You're nodding yes.
Music came easy to me.
Yeah. Until you made it hard, until you realized, I want to make it a little harder.
Well, my brain started to absorb it and chew it out. And it started going places where I realized that I no longer had the facility to go where my brain wanted me to go.
Yeah.
And then I had to make an adjustment. But I've always been able to absorb all music and pretty much put it in the same place. And it was always weird when I started working professionally because everybody tries to put things in little boxes.
Whereas to you, classical, jazz, all, let's bring it on.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
All of the things that I have done in my career, I put that into whatever music I'm doing at the time.
Well, let's listen to some. The new CD, Bragtown. By the way, Bragtown, neighborhood in Durham,
North Carolina,
where you've lived for a few years now.
Right.
Why do they call it Bragtown?
I have no idea, and no one else does either.
Okay.
That's kind of the cool thing about it.
If anyone knows out there in Durham.
They don't.
Okay. another piece from the CD is Blackzilla. We read your drummer, Jeff Tane Watts, composed it, inspired by, of course, the 53 Monster film. Let's listen. What's going on for you in this piece? What are you thinking?
I'm not really thinking anything. Thinking happens in the practice room. Now you're just reacting. I play football in high school, and it's very similar to what the coaches talk about. Because the time for thinking is in practice. In the game, you just react to what's going on. And that's pretty much how I approach this music. So what I play depends on what the other guys in the band play.
Yeah, I want to listen to some more of the music that you're talking about. This, again, from the CD Bragtown, is called Fate. And you were inspired by a Wagner leitmotif?
Right.
Which one?
The Fate leitmotif. It's most prevalent in operas 3 and 4, in God of Demerung and Siegfried in the Ring cycle. Called The New World. Terrible movie. But the opening music, as the sun came up on The New World, was the overture to Das Rheingold, which is the first opera in the Wagner tetralogy. And I said, oh my God, it's Das Rheingold. I haven't heard that in a while. And I put it on, and then for the hell of it, on my iPod, I also had Got a Demerung. And when I put it on in the first movement, the woman got to the leitmotif, and I said, oh my God, That's where I got it from.
That must be a scary thing for a composer.
No, it's cool.
It's okay. I mean, but when you don't find out in time.
Oh, it doesn't matter. It's how the brain works. I mean, when you listen to, I could sit down and point to you various examples where musicians steal things from other musicians. For instance, if you listen to Wagner's first opera, the Flying Dutchman, it sounds just like Verdi. And then in the middle of 20 minutes of Verdi comes 5 minutes of Wagner screaming out. And you say, wow, that's the departure. But it takes time. There's a process that has to occur for the departure to become the entire piece. You can hear the same thing when you hear Beethoven. Early Beethoven sounds like Mozart with these seconds of departure. And over the 8 symphonies, which takes 20 years to do or more, he slowly but surely becomes himself.
As you talk about the classical music, it reminds me, I was reading a review, you played a classical concert, I think it was in Australia, some Copland.
Right.
And the reviewer said an interesting thing, you were almost disappointingly good. And he meant that as a huge compliment. He said you were just so relaxed that it was sort of like, why isn't he sweating more? And it goes back to the thing that I had mentioned earlier, you know, there's this ease that you come, you know, from the Leno show on. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, if maybe...
Well, the Leno show is easy.
But even with the hard stuff, you have an ease.
No, I played a concert in 1987, 88, where I did this light classical record. Piece of cake. I get a gig with the Boston Pops. John Williams is conducting. And that's what I say to myself. Piece of cake. I know that music. Didn't practice it. I went on stage, forgot to breathe in the place, and had the worst case of flop sweat you ever want to see in your life. In the audience, and I guarantee you I'm not exaggerating here, they applauded out of sympathy. It was not a fun moment to be in, and what I learned from it was that you have to practice and approach even the simpler pieces in a certain way so that you earn the right to own them eventually, because Kathleen Battle came out and sang the piece she was singing. She sang it like she wrote it. That is something that is acquired over time. I first started playing with symphonies in 1998, and I assure you, there was nothing easy about it. I was sweating bullets every night, legs shaking. By the time we did the concert in Australia, there was a level of ease to it because I had been doing this long enough to not freak out anymore.
And you'd put the work in.
I put the work in, and I've stunk the house out a lot of times. And a lot of people say, well, man, why are you putting yourself through this? You know, because you have a career where you're set and you could just play easy, but I don't like easy. Easy doesn't settle well with me. I don't like the safe little place. And I'm going to go out there and try to do things that are going to challenge me and make me a better musician.
Jazzman Branford Marsalis, his new CD with the Branford Marsalis Quartet comes out today. It's called Bragtown. Branford, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's mine, Robert. Thank you.
For those of you in the Boston area, Branford will be performing tonight. For more information on that and other tour dates, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. From Arizona to Florida, we'll look at some new voter ID laws that could change the political landscape. Also, The New Yorker's man on terrorism, Lawrence Wright. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.